Politics is unusual or the new normal? What's the takeaway from a chaotic spectacle billed as the first presidential debate of this general election? That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. More on the so-called presidential debate, one which many analysts panned as neither a debate nor presidential. A brain-killing amoeba leads to a boil water notice in Lake Jackson, Texas, as officials attempt to answer questions surrounding the death of a six-year-old. Also, do cuts in police funding lead to increased crime rates? And the call for a broadband plan for the Lone Star State, Texas, one of only six without one. Those stories and a whole lot more when the National News Show of Texas gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 30th day of September 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. It's not often that the word clown appears in a banner headline in the New York Times, but to those who follow presidential politics, that might not come as much of a surprise on this Wednesday. Across Texas last night, as people tuned in to watch what was pitched as the first presidential debate of this year's general election, what started out as a train wreck rapidly turned into the sort of spectacle that might politely be described as an unwatchable circus. Whether it made any difference in the presidential race or in American politics in some larger dimension may depend upon your metric. James Riddlesberger is a political science professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth and a veteran observer of American presidential politics. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Happy to be here, as always.
Last night's debate was certainly not very substantive. A lot of caustic remarks, a bit hard to watch, actually. What are your initial thoughts on how this debate played out?
Well, I mean, it's obvious that President Trump had a tactic of disrupting the debate. He interrupted, I think someone said 73 times he interrupted Joe Biden. Joe Biden thought he was going to a debate and found himself at a mud wrestling contest instead, and really never gained his feet in terms of how to respond to that. I do think that Biden had two or three times when he turned to the camera and spoke directly to the American people where there was a kind of a shade of rationality to the debate. But it was otherwise almost a complete waste of time unless you like old and tired insults.
You know, it's interesting that you should count 73 times, I think, of interruptions. I would have thought the number was much higher just based on impact alone, but also that you made it all the way through. I wonder how many people clicked off their sets about 30 minutes in or so. How much did this alienate people from the process or from either of the candidates?
Yeah, I suspect that it probably confirmed the biases that people had going in. You know, the overnight poll that I saw showed that people thought about 48% thought that Biden won and 41% thought Trump won. Well, that's almost identical to what the national polling is showing right now in terms of the race. Yes, it was really bad theater. It was a theater without a plot. And from that standpoint, it was not entertaining or informative for voters. But for those voters who did stick it out, I suspect it confirmed the biases that they already had going into the debate. And of course, that's bad news for the president, who's consistently running 6, 7, 8 points behind in the polls.
Was there any moment in this debate that stood out to you at all amid the cacophony?
Well, I think that the opportunity for President Trump to disavow white racism and white supremacy was an opportunity that he missed. That should be the easiest softball to hit out of the park. And yet, when he was asked about white supremacist organizations, his response was stand back and stand by. In fact, not only not disavowing them, but encouraging them to be prepared for action should they be needed. That is not only out of the ordinary in terms of American politics, but it's actually could be dangerous in the hands of people who are already have propensities towards violence.
What do we lose? I mean, if this had been a normal presidential debate, what issues should we have really been hearing about last night that we didn't?
Well, I mean, the coronavirus, the election, the economy, you know, the things, tax rates, the things that people care about, and they make a difference in their day-to-day life. And we just simply didn't have a rational discussion about any of those topics that the moderator tried to bring up over and over again, and tried to modulate President Trump's behavior so there could be a discussion, completely in vain.
How does last night's debate bode for future ones? I mean, is it worth having these presidential debates if they're going to devolve into this sort of spectacle?
Well, I mean, the simple two-word answer to that, or two-letter answer to that, is no. That was a complete waste of a perfectly good hour and a half that I'll never get back. But it does reveal something about the character of the presidential candidates. And to the degree that character matters, I think that people can take that away. What is their demeanor? How do they interact with others? Can they work with others? Are they willing to listen to others? Those are the kinds of things that I think we have come to in terms of presidential debates, not evaluating debates themselves. I mean, I remember trying to score the debates as far back as 1980, and we saw the first debate, and everyone scored it and said, well, Jimmy Carter won on points. But of course, what we didn't realize is that Jimmy Carter lost badly on leadership issues and on character issues to Ronald Reagan, and that reshaped the entire election. So since that time, we simply have not tried to evaluate debates based upon debate points. Calling them debates, of course, is a misnomer to begin with. They're joint public appearances. There is no rebuttal. There is no scoring. And so it doesn't have any of the characteristics of real debate.
James Riddlesberger is a political science professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. Professor Riddlesberger, thanks for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Always delighted to be with you.
Residents of Lake Jackson, Texas, remain under a boil water notice today in the wake of the death of a 6-year-old who'd been playing in a splash pad earlier this month. That death has been blamed on a brain-eating amoeba that apparently made its way into the local water supply. Yesterday, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality warned the boil water notice could remain in effect up to 3 more weeks as officials use chemicals to, quote, scour the system, hoping to kill the amoebas, which have been traced to the city's freshwater source, Lake Jackson. And they said it was unclear how unfiltered water could have ended up in the system in the first place. Pratheet Kulkarni is an assistant professor of medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Dr. Kulkarni, welcome.
Good morning, David. Happy to be with you.
What is this amoeba exactly, this disease that that the child died from? How is that normally contracted? And I do understand it's rather rare.
Yes. As you mentioned, it is exceedingly rare. There are usually less than 10 cases per year diagnosed in the United States. The amoeba, called Naegleria fowleri, is normally found in warm, freshwater environments, such as lakes, ponds, rivers, and streams. And the organism normally causes infection by entering the brain, actually, through the nose. It's inhaled, and that's how the infection occurs.
So how unusual is it to have this amoeba found in a drinking water system?
The vast majority of cases that have been reported since this organism was discovered in the 1960s have been reported after exposure to these environmental freshwater locations. It is exceedingly rare, actually, for it to be found in the municipal water supply. There was a time in 2013 to 2014 when a similar situation occurred in Louisiana, and they had to undertake kind of a remediation, decontamination plan. I understand similar efforts are underway currently in Lake Jackson in consultation with state authorities and CDC as well.
In fact, you're quite correct. Toby Baker, who's the head of the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, says that it could take up to 3 weeks before this boil water notice is lifted. And they're talking about trying to get chlorine levels to a state that can, in his words, burn the entire system, scour the drinking water system and kill the amoebas, and that could take quite a while. How do you get rid of an amoeba like this? It appears that it can't survive chlorine?
That's exactly right. The most common way that decontamination occurs to get the chlorine levels to sufficient quantity to be able to get rid of the organism. that's what's being done here, and that's the normal way that it happens.
I think a lot of people who rely on water that comes from a freshwater source may be rather concerned about the fact that this just exists in fresh water. What do you say to people who are concerned about the fact that this amoeba can live and, in fact, thrive in some of these freshwater reservoirs?
Right. I completely understand, actually, that concern. It's exceedingly rare for it to be in the municipal water supply or the drinking water supply because there is routine testing of chlorine levels and things like that to ensure that the drinking water supply is generally safe. The more likely risk or potentially getting the organism is actually through the direct contact with those freshwater environments. Now, the risk is relatively low if, for example, you go swimming in a lake or a river or something like that. But still, that's probably the more likely way that somebody would get exposed to it rather than the drinking water supply.
Is boiling your drinking water an effective way to kill the amoeba?
Yes, I would follow the advisory put out by the city of Lake Jackson about boiling water to use it for drinking and for cooking. So I would follow all of those pieces of guidance, boil the water as has been advised.
We will link to more information about what precautions to take over at texasstandard.org. Pratheet Kulkarni is an assistant professor of medicine who specializes in infectious diseases at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. Dr. Kulkarni, thanks for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, David.
Joining us on this Wednesday hour, social media editor Wells Dunbar, and I bet I know what Texans are talking about today.
Yes, sir. We're hearing from our friends and listeners about last night's so-called debate between Democratic hopeful Joe Biden and President Donald Trump, who unceasingly interrupted the proceedings. Echoing what we just heard at the top of the show, many folks calling for a new way forward should there be any more debates. On Facebook, Ashton Plummer says the moderator should have been able to cut the mics. All the interruptions were ridiculous. And via Twitter, Alan says the next debate needs to be done via Zoom, and if it's not a candidate's turn, they should be muted. Katie Gray says she was disappointed, annoyed, and wished issues could have actually been discussed more substantively. More people also noting President Trump's refusal to disavow white supremacist groups, specifically the Proud Boys, with that instruction to, quote, stand down and stand by. I'll be back with more reactions to that and other moments from last night later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you, Texas. Let us know what you thought about the debate, would you? Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. He's our social media editor, and he'll be back in about 35 minutes or so with more of the talk of Texas. We're fast approaching 19 minutes past the hour.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Right now, migratory species are making their way southward through Texas. Perhaps you've seen the monarch butterflies or birds that aren't typically native to the area. But there's an alarming difference this year. Thousands of dead birds have been found. The Standard's Alexandra Hart wanted to learn more.
Earlier this month, something unusual happened. Birds, thousands of them, seemingly died overnight in New Mexico. So Jenna McCullough went to investigate.
I was notified by a colleague that there were birds in the Sandias that were acting abnormally and dead. I and my fellow PhD student, Nick Vinciguerra, went out and collected 305 birds.
McCullough is a PhD student in ornithology at the University of New Mexico. She got her first call about the bird deaths on September 10th. For days afterwards, concerned citizens reached out to her with more sightings. When she and her research partner went out to investigate, all they found were feathers.
And so what that kind of points to is that birds, there might have been a mass die-off, but that birds aren't continuously dying.
That's the good news, sort of. When reports first surfaced of birds dying en masse in New Mexico, Colorado, and even potentially in parts of West Texas, there was concern that deaths were ongoing. Early reports speculated on the causes: wildfires on the West Coast, or poisoning, or widespread drought. And while those things could be a cause, McCullough says the more likely explanation is a cold snap. Right before she started fielding calls, a historic cold front blew through the Southwest, blanketing many areas with early snow.
And that makes sense because it was hot. It was actually abnormally warm. And then it crashed like 55, 60 degrees overnight after a huge windstorm, too.
Most of the birds that died were migratory. They had been flying long distances, which puts their bodies under a lot of stress, even in good conditions. And when the snow came, those insects they normally feed on to fuel their journeys just disappeared. That lack of food likely caused many of the birds to starve or die of hypothermia. Cliff Shackelford is the state ornithologist for non-game birds for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He explains it this way.
So these birds were caught up in a system that they were stuck in for days. So that's like you and me driving from, say, South Dakota to Texas, and you can't find any gas stations.
He says that migratory birds in Texas were mostly spared from this particular die-off, but it's happened here before.
Early in my career, in October of 2000, we had the exact same thing happen. That's 20 years ago, so it's not common.
A cold front like the one that happened a few weeks ago pushed through from the Dakotas down to Texas as birds were flying south.
And I was living in Austin at the time. There were piles of swallows in various places.
Die-offs like this can be alarming, but Shackelford says they're quite rare. He says the biggest ongoing threats to birds are man-made ones.
Clearing land, building houses, putting in subdivisions, building big box stores. We don't ever think about that because we don't see piles of birds. Habitat loss is a daily, hourly issue for birds.
McCullough and her New Mexico team are still waiting for autopsy results for the birds they found. It'll take a while. They had to send the birds to a lab in Oregon where fires are causing a slowdown. But as for the early wildfire theory that spread in the news and on social media like, well, wildfire, she says it's too soon to tell.
We don't really know how birds respond to smoke hundreds of miles away from the actual fires. I do think that there needs to be research, and I am very interested in the autopsies that are going to be done.
In Austin, I'm Alexandra Hart for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The pandemic has been hard on everyone, but especially hard for those of us who don't have dependable access to high-speed internet. One thing that might have helped: a statewide broadband plan. You know, 44 states have one, but Texas does not, even though over 2 million Texans don't have access to high-speed internet, according to the state controller's office. That's got to get fixed, and fixed fast, according to a group of nearly 90 state lawmakers who recently sent a letter to Governor Abbott calling for just such a thing, a statewide broadband plan. Joining us now is one of the authors of that letter, State Representative Trent Ashby, a Republican from Lufkin. Representative Ashby, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you having me on your program today.
If you could paint a picture, a general picture of the broadband situation in rural Texas, what would that look like?
Well, the 2 million Texans you cited earlier that have no access to internet capabilities, many of those, of course, are located in our remote and rural areas of the state. And so, you know, coronavirus has really highlighted and laid bare the challenges that many rural Texans face in terms of connectivity. And certainly, as you cited the letter to the governor, that was our desire, was to highlight the problems that we're experiencing currently and ask for his help in developing a statewide broadband plan.
I think a lot of people would be surprised that the state doesn't have such a plan. Why not?
Well, that's a great question, and I really don't have an answer for that. But there just really hasn't been a coordinated effort in recent memory to go about creating a plan. But once we get into session, I think it's very likely that this will be a top priority for many legislators to try to bridge that divide, as well as make sure that we have affordable internet services. There was a study done here in the Deep East Texas region And the people that do have broadband in limited parts of this 12-county region, mm-hmm. they're paying 400% more for their internet than many of our urban counterparts. So we also want to make sure that that disparity does not continue to exist.
I think you're touching on an issue here that perhaps many in the state, many of your fellow lawmakers sort of see this as primarily an economic matter that can be solved by the private sector. That is to say, if it's not economically feasible to get broadband to everybody, well, there's a reason for that. There's the practical considerations. What would a broadband plan look like if the state were to take on such a thing?
Well, largely the funding already exists, and of course it is housed at the federal level, but part of the issue here is that when applications are submitted from the state of Texas, automatically they are at a multiple point deficit in terms of grading because we don't have a statewide broadband plan. So just by us enacting a plan, we will see our stature improved in terms of the possibility of being awarded grants. But yes, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned the private sector. They are obviously a key component in making sure that this is successful. They have to, of course, have a return on their investment. But there is a way here, other states have done it, to go about leveraging federal and private dollars to incentivize the system so that we can see that broadband deployment built out across our great state.
You mentioned that the legislature is likely to take this up. Do you think that by the end of next year's legislative session, well, what will have changed when it comes to this question of the broadband plan?
Of course, our hope is by the end of next session, we have a formal statewide broadband plan in place. You know, there was approximately 90 House members, urban, suburban, and rural, that all came together to sign off on this letter. And so I think there will be broad, bipartisan, geographical support for this effort.
State Representative Trent Ashby is a Republican from Lufkin. He's one of the lawmakers leading a bipartisan push for a comprehensive broadband plan for the state of Texas. Representative Ashby, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
David, thanks for having me on today.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Texas A&M University researchers estimate the state could see billions of dollars in new funding if it expands Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Texas is one of just a dozen states that has not done so. Elena Marks heads the Episcopal Health Foundation, which sponsored the report. She explains if the projected 954,000 newly eligible Texans enroll in health insurance under an expansion, it would cost $6 billion.
And the way the Medicaid expansion program works, the federal government pays 90% of the cost and the state pays 10% of the cost. And so if you apply that formula to the total of $6 billion, what you find is that the federal government would contribute $5.4 billion and the state would contribute another $600 million.
Texas has the highest percentage of uninsured people in the U.S. Rio Grande Valley officials are getting $250,000 to support polling locations from a nationwide grant program Arnold Schwarzenegger started. Texas Public Radio's Ronaldo Leaños Jr. reports the former California governor and actor joined the Cameron County Commissioner's Court for the announcement Tuesday.
The grant received by the county comes from the Schwarzenegger Institute for State and Global Policy at the University of Southern California. The money will be used to help increase voter access and operation of polling in the county, which includes opening two voting supercenters.
They will give the ability of 20 to 24,000 voters to vote. And, you know, so many people are out there talking about and inspiring other people to go out and vote. And I said, that is all great, but if you don't have always the ability to vote, it makes it very difficult.
Schwarzenegger says he's happy to invest in a project like this because it allows everyone to participate in our democracy and vote. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
American astronauts are planning to cast their ballots for the November election from the International Space Station. Houston native Shannon Walker is on the NASA crew leaving Earth next month aboard a commercial SpaceX rocket. During a briefing at the Johnson Space Center Tuesday, Walker described the process.
They basically send you an electronic file. It's a PDF, and you mark your choices, and then you email it back to the person who's in charge of the election for the county. And so then that gets counted into all the ballots that are brought back.
Texas lawmakers cleared the way for voting from space in 1997. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Two eye-catching billboards were recently put up along I-35 just outside the Texas capital city. The billboards read, "Austin Police Defunded. Enter at your own risk." The signs were put there by a police lobbying group after the Austin City Council cut millions from the police budget. The sign's message is that if you spend less on police, crime will go up. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey puts that premise to the test.
In 2009, the city of Austin's police budget was about $230 million. A decade later, we were spending nearly twice as much on police. So, with all that money, has Austin gotten safer over time? The answer is sort of. In 2009, the violent crime rate was 4.76 per every 1,000 residents in the city. To put it another way, that's one murder, rape, robbery, or aggravated assault per every 200 residents. Over the next couple of years, as we spent more money on police, that number trickled down. And then it went up a little. And then back down. And then up a little. So that by 2016, we had nearly the same violent crime rate as 2010. Even though we were spending $130 million more on police. In other words, as spending on police went up and up and up and up, violent crime rates fluctuated.
There's no evidence that spending more on police all by itself does any good at all.
Bill Spellman's a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a former city council member. And he says rather than asking how big the police department's budget is, you have to ask how that money's being spent.
There is some evidence that putting more patrol officers on the street has a small negative effect on later crime rates.
So will the city council's budget cuts affect the number of officers in Austin? The answer is yes. About $13 million of what the council cut from police represents the canceling of three cadet training classes. So no new officers for the next year. Although Police Chief Brian Manley has said he'll try to keep the same number of police on the streets. But the department estimates that by next September, we'll have fewer full-time officers than we had in 2014. Here's Emily Owens, a professor at the University of California, Irvine.
If police spending or changes in the police budgets leads to changes in the number of police on the street, that might, all else equal, is something that's probably going to lead to a change in crime rates.
Owen says a body of research suggests a relationship between police presence and lower crime rates. The idea is that if you see a police officer on the street, you're less likely to commit a crime. A study out of Princeton University found that cities that got federal grants to hire more police saw a 3.5% reduction in crime. The eight experts I talked to for the story all agree that there's no correlation between the size of a police department's budget and crime. But what about the number of police officers and crime? Depends on who I asked. Some experts said research shows a relationship, and others said it didn't. So we'll have fewer police officers in Austin, and we may not know what that'll mean for crime rates. Which brings me to another point Owens made.
What I see in the sort of defund the police movement and the push to reduce spending on police officers is, to be glib, not to reduce spending on police and then set that money on fire.
Owens has researched the effects that social services can have on crime. In one study, she found that building low-income housing in a neighborhood has the potential to lower violent crime rates. And while she and her co-author admitted that having more police might have had a bigger impact on crime, housing provided another social good. Well, housing. Which brings us back to the central argument of those who support taking money from the police department and spending it elsewhere.
Are there other ways we could spend this money? Does it all have to go to the police?
Scott Henson is the policy director at the nonprofit Just Liberty. So far, the council's re-spent $20 million of its proposed total $150 million in cuts. That money is going to public health, housing, and to a family violence shelter. Henson argues that if there's no connection between the size of a police department's budget and violent crime rates, why keep spending?
To me, this is an example of what normally is a conservative critique of government, where we keep throwing money at this problem on the assumption that more money makes us safer, but we don't really know.
Although, as I've mentioned, there is some evidence that spending the money on officers could keep crime rates down. Either way, the city council will continue to ask themselves and the public Henson's question: should this money be spent elsewhere? There's still $50 million of what they cut up in the air. Will they decide to keep it within the police department or dissolve some divisions and pay for something else entirely? They'll spend the next several months deciding. I'm Audrey McGlinchey in Austin.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Longtime listeners know that many days around this time in the broadcast, we bring you the stories of everyday Texans in their own words, and we do that again here. But today, we need to warn parents and sensitive listeners that the experience you're about to hear involves the serious subject of child sexual abuse. In just a few minutes, we'll hear about work being done to help survivors.
Hi, my name is Lisa Michelle. I am the founder and executive director of No Strings Attached in San Antonio, Texas. And I am a survivor of child sex trafficking. Every time I tell my story, I go in with the mindset of I'm doing it for the one. I know that somebody's going to hear my voice, somebody's going to identify with my story, and they will raise their voice. My first vivid memory was when I was 7 years old. I was actually trafficked by a businessman that ran our local funeral home in our city. He was married. He had an apartment on top of that funeral home. He would have me and other girls and boys spend the night there on the weekends, and he would drug us, and then he sexually exploited us through the use of child pornography. My mom was going through a divorce with my dad, and times were very tumultuous in our household. There was a lot going on, my dad getting arrested for beating her on a regular basis. And unfortunately, I ended up over in that funeral home because it was what my mom had considered a safe place at the time. And if she had any idea that any of those horrible things were happening there, she absolutely would never have let that happen on her own watch. I know that. My dad, on the other hand, you know, he didn't care. He could care less. I could have came from a perfect family, and who's to say some of those other victims weren't of that nature, because he was a grandfather type figure that was very kind. The entire community respected him as a businessman. And nobody had any idea the darkness that happened inside that funeral home. Nobody. One of the things that I like to get across is that my school teachers, the school nurse, There were so many people, the people in ER and the doctors that came in contact with me and saw the bruises on me, saw that I was struggling in school and couldn't make my grades, saw my behavior and me acting out. I started smoking pot and drinking at the age of 12. That's not normal. And I would self-harm. So when you see a child acting out that pain, but nobody's really reaching in to that child and reaching in and finding out where their pain is and what's going on with them and saying, what happened to you? If you think it's not happening in your neighborhood, then you are already behind the game. Just choose one child to help. My name is Lisa Michelle. I am the executive director for No Strings Attached. And I am a survivor of sexual exploitation and trafficking, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Child survivors of human trafficking often have to work toward their own mental and emotional healing. It's as if there is no set prescription, for lack of a better word. Scientists here in Texas are trying to learn more as we speak, not so much about which medical treatments are effective, but which work best for different age groups. Dr. Jeff Newport teaches psychiatry and behavioral sciences at UT's Dell Medical School. He's also the director of psychiatric services at The Refuge, a Central Texas organization working toward the healing of child survivors of human trafficking. He's one of the leading researchers in this area. Dr. Newport, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about some baselines here. Has human trafficking slowed, disappeared during COVID? What do you know about the situation during the pandemic?
It certainly has not slowed and definitely not disappeared. And of course, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, we're just scratching the surface in terms of being able to identify young women and girls who are in trafficking and, you know, freeing them up from those circumstances and getting them into supportive services and treatment where needed.
The stories that these young women we just heard from may make many think that their recovery can be a lifelong process. And I guess the question is this type of trauma curable or no?
I think it's accurate to say it's a lifelong process in that it's something that will continue to leave scars, and the effects of the trauma will resurface from time to time in different contexts. But they can reach a point with proper care and proper help and building of new tools and strategies to cope with the stresses that life throws at them, the capacity to no longer have that trauma dominate their lives so that they have freedom from the effects of the trauma.
So we're talking about treatment. How is treating children different from treating adults, grown-ups?
Well, that's a process that we're actually learning, to be quite honest. One of the things about human trafficking that we have to recognize is what we call a complex trauma, in that the sexual victimization is the part of the trauma that is most notable. But the thing we have to recognize is it doesn't happen in a vacuum. All of their supports, social supports, family supports, and the like are ripped away from them when they're in these contexts. And so it's helping them to rebuild those components that are going to be necessary to a happy and well-adjusted adult life. And primarily that focuses on a couple of different psychotherapies that we're using. So we're combining those psychotherapies when necessary with medication. And not all these young women will need medication, but some of them will, to manage the worst of their symptoms. And what we're doing is borrowing from lessons that we've learned with adults who've experienced similar traumas and applying that as best we know how in this situation with young adolescents.
Let's talk about that issue of applying this as best we know how, because I gather that a lot of the research into childhood trauma has been focused on survivors of child abuse or intrafamily violence, that sort of thing. Not so much human trafficking. Am I correct there?
That's correct. That's correct. And again, there are certain similarities, as I mentioned, but what goes beyond what we often see in some of these abuse situations is the complex nature of the trauma. But there's enough similarity that we think that we're on the right track with the interventions and the treatments that we're offering these young women at the refuge.
Let's talk about long term here. What's your hope? A year, 2 years, 3 years on out, there might be, say, published research that emerges from the work that you're doing. I mean, how do you see this playing out long term?
Yeah, I think the data collection period after about a year to 18 months, we'll probably have a sufficient amount of data to begin analyzing and then prepare for publication. So I'm cautiously optimistic that within 2 years or so, we should be able to begin producing results that will guide others who are beginning to work in this field.
Dr. Jeff Newport teaches psychiatry and behavioral sciences at UT's Dell Medical School. He's also the director of psychiatric services at the Refuge. We'll have more at texasstandard.org. Dr. Newport, thanks again for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. U.S. Congressman Michael Burgess, a Republican from North Texas, says that in the last 10 years, less than half of adults in the U.S. received a flu shot. Is that a fact? Each week, we're joined by PolitiFact Texas's Madeline Meckelberg, who looks into claims just like these, or very similar. Madeline, welcome back.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
Where did this particular claim from Burgess originate?
So Congressman Burgess said this in a tweet. As I'm sure you know, we're coming up on flu season, and health officials have been encouraging people to get their flu shot and get their flu shot early. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Our healthcare professionals and our healthcare systems are battling COVID-19. They're stressing that we need to get our flu shot and make sure that we're not overburdening these systems. And Congressman Burgess joined in on those calls in this tweet, and he asked his followers, I'm quoting here, "Did you know in the last 10 years, less than half of adults in the U.S. received a flu shot? This flu season, I hope you will consider getting your flu vaccination despite all of the social distancing measures that are in place around the country."
Let's consider this claim, though. Less than half of adults, fewer than half of adults received a flu shot in the past 10 years. How'd you go about checking this claim?
So I turned to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they monitor flu shot coverage for different age groups over time. And I'll say that they do recommend you get an annual flu shot. The influenza vaccine is a little bit different every year, depending on what kind of virus we're dealing with. So it makes sense to look at coverage for each year, because that's when people are supposed to be getting their flu shot. So looking big picture at all adults, not digging into the age groups, the CDC estimates show that since 2010, fewer than half of all adults got a flu shot each year during flu season. It was at a high in 2014 when 43.6% of adults got their flu shot, but it went to a low in 2017 when just 37.1% got their flu shot. But that's when we're talking about all adults. As you might imagine, there's some variation when we talk about different age groups and when we bring kids into the equation, even though that's not really what he was talking about here. Children see a high rates of vaccination, and adults who are 65 years or older tend to get vaccinated at higher rates than the population at large. About 60% of those over 65 get vaccinated each year with the flu shot.
Yet, if you look at the aggregate number for all adults, it still is below that 50% mark, if I hear you correctly, right?
That's exactly right. I spoke with a few doctors and health experts, and there are a lot of different factors that contribute here. And of course, it depends on the individual and their circumstances. But when you're talking about children and these older adults, they tend to go to the doctor more because of their age. An adult who's between maybe 18 and 49 is going to be seeing their physician maybe one time a year in the best case scenario. So they're less likely to be in front of a physician who's going to be reminding them to get their flu shot, who can actually administer that shot, things of that nature. There's also a lot of misinformation about the influenza infection in general, the vaccine, how frequently shots are necessary, and that can contribute to these low numbers. We also have cost as a factor. Flu shots tend to be free if you have health insurance coverage, but if you don't, they can range from $40 to $70, depending on whether it's a high-dose vaccine.
So even though we see these advertisements for free flu shots and there's all this communication from healthcare professionals and that sort of thing, not everyone is taking advantage of it, in part because they're not getting these constant reminders. They're not seeing their healthcare professional or a physician more than once a year, if that at best. And so we are, well, it sounds like below that 50% marker. Is it, well, are you ready for a ruling?
I'm ready if you are.
Okay, well, what did you rule on this claim from Congressman Burgess?
We rated this claim true.
True, PolitiFact's ruling on Michael Burgess's claim that in the last 10 years, fewer than half of adults in the U.S. received a flu shot. One final note. It's a bit of a sad one. Madeline, this will be the last time you join us for these segments. Is that right?
It's right. I'm so sad.
What will you be doing?
I'm going to be moving over to cover the environment, energy, politics issues at the Statesman, but I'm leaving you in good hands. Brandon Mulder is going to be taking over as the PolitiFact Texas reporter, so you can look forward to hearing from him.
Brandon Mulder will be in this position next week, and we will be reading Madeline Meckelberg in the pages of the Austin American Statesman and online at statesman.com. Madeline, thanks so much, and we hope you'll join us again sometime, somewhere, somehow.
Thank you. Me too. I'm counting on it.
And you are listening
to the Texas Standard.
Wells Dunbar monitoring the talk of Texas on this Wednesday. Hello again, Wells.
Hello, David. Yes, the presidential debate, the talk of social media still. Everyone, I think I saw it well by put well by one user on my Twitter timeline that the hangover was apparent on Twitter this morning as everyone recovers from the debate last night. And of course, the big takeaway happens to be the president's refusal to disavow some white supremacist and white nationalist supporters there, getting a lot of digital ink, if you will, online. Specifically, his words to the one group called the Proud Boys to stand down and stand by, just receiving lots of folks really offended by the president's words there. The Sage Leopard tweets this: "Yikes! Inciting violence for voter intimidation is not presidential." And interestingly enough, too, I've seen on Twitter today some folks circulating a meme that is actually being shared among the Proud Boys and many other white supremacist groups. A photo of Kyle Rittenhouse. He was the teenager charged in for killing a protester in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Picture of him with the president's words superimposed on that picture. So honestly, some folks taking that as a call to arms, if you will. Hearing from other people about other moments about during the debate that are captured their attention, Caitlin Lay says that Joe Biden telling Trump to shut up was pretty much the only part I enjoyed. The president not without his supporters, of course. Gina tweets us that while Trump interrupted too much, Biden, in her estimation, was disrespectful out of the gate. He was smug, and the name-calling did not do him any favors. And another really remarkable moment, in my estimation, David, was the president's spiel towards the end of the debate, really calling into question the validity of the election, calling into question the fact that people are voting by mail, and really just remarkable to see a sitting president call into question the very concept of the election itself, and that idea has not been lost on some of our listeners as well. Ideen Salehan, he tweets us that Governor Greg Abbott should make a clear, unequivocal statement about electoral integrity in Texas. He adds, "We cannot let any candidate falsely claim that the election was rigged." And again, we saw there at the end of the program, Joe Biden saying, "Yes, you know, once this election is over, all the votes are counted. I will abide by those, by the verdict, by the verdict of the American voters." The president declining to do so. So very remarkable historic moment. We saw there last night, David.
Yeah, presidential debate, neither of those words really applying in this case. Yeah. And I think a lot of people wondering just what the future of the debates might be, although I noted that Joe Biden's team had said that he would participate in number two. Interesting take in the New York Times: debate prompts shock, despair, and in China, glee. The chaos of the debate leaving allies and rivals alike wondering about American democracy and the country's place in the world. A whole lot of fallout after one night's political spectacle. We continue to take in your comments at texasstandard.org. We hope you'll visit us there. Until tomorrow, when we'll be back on the broadcast, we hope you'll join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.